the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, you're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Born and raised in Spokane and a Gonzaga graduate, Ryan Harnato is the managing partner of Equus Sports LLC, the owner of Spokane's new USL soccer teams, the FC Zephyr in the top flight of women's soccer and FC Velocity of men's USL League One. Along with his wife, Katie, Ryan aims to build a community-based club driven by their passion for sports in Spokane.
There he is.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good. How's it going?
Good, man. Good. Are you on in Spokane right now? Or?
Got here last night. Yep. Just here for a day.
All right. Living the dream, man. Living the dream.
Yeah.
Hey, well, thanks for joining us. This is, I've been excited about this for some time. And full disclosure, I've known you for a while.
Yeah.
And I just know you're dynamic and got tons of energy and tons of good ideas. So let's get this thing rocking. What do you say? I know.
I love it. I'm excited to be here. And this is, I think, my first podcast, maybe I've commented on, and we've been pretty heads down on everything. So it's good to catch up, and always love something related to Gonzaga. So it's great.
Yeah. So you are for folks just joining or starting with, they didn't read the description, I suppose. you are one of the many owners of the new USL clubs. There's two clubs, I guess, or maybe one club, but two teams, the Zephyr and the Velocity in Spokane. We're going to get to that. But you're a Spokane guy. Take me from the beginning. Growing up in Spokane, right? Went to Gonzaga. So what? Give me kind of the background, right?
Yeah. So class of 1991, Gonzaga Prep. Katie was a class of 93, Lewis and Clark High School. As a matter of fact, she graduated with my sister, Trish. We never knew each other in high school. Katie and I did not, but we of course met famously at Camp Reed. And we did that in 1995. And as it goes at Camp Reed, we struck up the Camp Reed romance that was short-lived and then came back and circled back around to us a few years later when we reconnected after college. So longtime Spokane guy, and we live in Seattle area now. We live in Bellevue, but still have folks here. And family and friends everywhere over here. So we kind of view ourselves as a foot on each side of the mountains. So
yeah, that's awesome. At first, I always thought you were an LC guy, but
no. Well, Katie was an LC gal. So
yeah.
So
and for folks out there, Katie is his wife, who's also a superstar, and we'll probably talk pretty extensively about some of the cool stuff that she's done.
Yeah.
For sure. And I know you started your career wealth management, I believe, in Spokane, had a full career, and then eventually and you started your family here, your kids were here, and eventually you went over to the West Side, I think probably for some business opportunities.
Right? Yeah. So Katie and I, Katie's a couple years younger, as I mentioned, and I graduated from Gonzaga in 90. Actually, my graduation year was 1996, but I was done in December of 95. And I moved from Spokane over to Seattle. I was going to go to law school, actually, and ended up meeting someone who worked at an investment firm at Murphy Favor, which is what it was called way, way, way back when. And I ended up deciding to move to Seattle after Christmas of 1995 and really start work and just kind of like get into the flow of things. I never intended on going into wealth management at all. Just one of those things that happened because I graduated in the middle of the year, basically. And had taken the LSAT and was kind of like thinking about where I wanted to go to school, could have been Gonzaga. And then I just wound up in the Seattle area. And then once I did that, I just kind of like hit the ground running with that. It was a really good fit for me. And so, you know, worked for a guy who was at the time a really, you know, kind of one of the more well-known producers at Reagan McKenzie after I left Murphy Favor, and really just kind of ended up falling in love with understanding how companies operated. And Reagan McKenzie was kind of a bottoms up value research shop and investment firm. And so I mean, it's kind of ironic that I'm on this podcast because stepping into the Jepson Center when I was an undergraduate at Gonzaga, it was always terrifying to me. I was a political science major, and business hadn't totally been on my radar. So, one thing led to another, and I ended up working for a guy, and then I ended up on my own building a practice in the Seattle area. So Katie and I were there, and Katie graduated from Gustavus Adolphus, which is a Lutheran university in Minnesota. And she ended up moving to Seattle. We started, there. She started in advertising and marketing, got her master's degree in Seattle at Seattle U after she graduated from undergrad. And I was just kind of hit the ground running with work. And that led us to Spokane about 10 years later, after we had our first child. So we moved back to Spokane, and we're in the Spokane area for about 10 years. And so we moved back to Seattle area in, 2012, maybe. So we've been back there for 12, 13 years almost. So.
Gotcha. Yeah. Two points of reference. I know your dad is not only an attorney, but a playwright.
Yeah, my dad's a Gonzaga alum, class of 1969. My mom is also. They graduated whatever day it was in 1969. They got married the next day. My dad started law school that summer at Gonzaga. And back in those days, you could do law school in 4 years at Gonzaga. And my mom and dad, my dad went to law school. My mom started working as a teacher, and the rest was history. So my dad was an import from Southern California, Huntington Beach, LA kid. My mom was from the farm in Hera, Washington, which is in the Yakima Valley. I grew up, my grandfather was a hop farmer, and she was one of seven. And so Gonzaga was, my dad ended up being one of, I think, five out of the six kids in his family ended up going through Gonzaga University in some, either for undergrad or grad school. And so it was a lot of history on my dad's side. And as a matter of fact, my dad's aunt was in the first class at Gonzaga that had women in the university. And her picture's hanging in the wall there in the ad building. So a lot of heritage at Gonzaga. So
yeah, it feels like there should be like a Harnetto lounge or something.
Yeah, exactly.
You paid enough tuition, right? So
well, yeah, my daughter just graduated from there a year ago, so I know the pain. I know the tuition.
Hey, someone's got to keep me in the lifestyle I'm accustomed to. So I appreciate
somebody's got to pay for those long weekends.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So over in Seattle, and I know for a time, Katie is in marketing and sales. I know she's been with a couple, I would call them consulting firms, but she eventually ends up with the big time.
Yeah. So Katie worked for a big ad agency when she was just out of college. Before she went back to grad school, she worked for a big ad agency, had just kind of entry-level account coordinator at a firm over there called Publicis, which is one of the biggest ad agencies in the world. I think they're actually called something else now. But then she went back to grad school. And when we started having kids, she took quite a bit of time off. And she went back to marketing and branding, when our youngest was maybe two and a half. And we, at that point, had moved back to Seattle. And we really, Katie was ready to kind of get back into things. And at the time, it was really hard not to just jump back into something exciting and fun in Seattle because there's so many great companies headquartered there. So she was with a firm for a while. Then she went to Starbucks and ran brand marketing for their tea business. So she spent a number of years at Starbucks headquarters over there. And then from there, she made the jump. I think I was at Merrill Lynch at the time or Morgan Stanley, but she made the jump to Amazon and help them launch their basically their kind of they don't like to call it this, but their version of Etsy. Amazon had a business line in there called Handmade. And the great thing about Amazon is, Katie went there as the global head of marketing for Amazon Handmade, which is this new entity, and it did very well. And Amazon is just a collection of companies inside the bigger company. And so she ended up over her course of her career there being in some brand marketing roles, but also as a GM of some of the businesses that she worked in. And so including Handmade, their sports and outdoors business, she ran that for a couple of years. And then she was tapped to run marketing for basically consumer marketing in the US. And that was the position she was in for a number of years before I talked her out of being there and coming over and working full time for the club in Spokane, which was quite an adjustment coming out of a company with 1.5 million employees where, it's like, wow, they do things quite differently there at Amazon. But, this endeavor in Spokane was I needed to hire somebody who could really help run the day-to-day ops because I've got my hands full with a lot of other things. And I talked Katie into doing it full time. Mostly it was just trying to make her not have to work 100-hour work week, because after her 70-hour work week in her Amazon job, running a team of 100 people or more, I would always just download what I was working on with the Spokane project with the club, and she would end up working another 5 or 6 hours after she was done with her normal job. So it was kind of one of those things. It's kind of like, if you can't beat them, join them. And, she had a lot of passion and does have a lot of passion for this, but she was, deep into a pretty good career there at Amazon. And I kind of pried her away from it. So we're really lucky that she did that. And we've got her for a while. So it's good.
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge steal for you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
100%.
And maybe you should have been a lawyer with these negotiation skills. It's,
I think it was almost more like she was already practically doing the job in some fashion through me. And, this project has been it's a family affair. Do you know what I mean? You can't do this alone. Everybody hopefully knows that by now, but this is a family project. This is, I had the vision of this. We can talk about that whenever you want to, but it's like, you kind of get swept up in it because it's Spokane. We both grew up here. We don't live here presently, but we're pretty passionate about the community. We understand what sports means to the community. And we are a sports and business family. And so when this came along, purely by accident, I assure you, it was almost like, I just was almost like, why wouldn't I do this? And I frankly, at the time that I made a phone call to figure out what was happening over here in Spokane, I really knew nothing about it, to be fair. But after I got off about a 90-minute phone call, I was like, I really kind of felt like, who else would do this? You know what I mean? I couldn't really imagine someone else doing it better than what I had envisioned for it after I began thinking about it, which is, of course, like you try not to make that be hubris, right? And but we had a pretty clear vision for what we thought it could be, especially me. It was crystal clear to me. And so, this story has been published in many places, but I literally got off the phone. First phone call I made about it, I called Cindy Chipman. Asked her like what was going on. I saw the stadium was starting to be built downtown, which I thought was kind of outrageous for Spokane, very, very un-Spokane like in how the stadium ended up becoming downtown. And it took a couple twists and turns to get there. But once I was I heard about it and understood a little bit more about the deal that USL had at least struck with the Spokane Public Facilities District at the outset, I was pretty intrigued by it. So, because these clubs, they require a stadium where you have a certain amount of access and control. It's the only way they work economically. And I dug into that for about 6 months or so before we decided to finally pull the trigger on it. It took quite a bit of due diligence on that side. And we talked about that too, just kind of understanding how these clubs work, is what is this? You know what I mean? How does the business entity function? And you were kind of early on in my process about that, because I came to you looking for some bright students that were maybe a year or two out of school. So anyway, it's been a journey. I'll just say that.
So at the time you are, were you retired from Merrill Lynch or from Wealth Management?
Yeah. So, well, the other part of the story was in 2018, I had spent about a year prior to that trying to kind of unwind my practice at Merrill Lynch, because I got the bug to go to work in the Bay Area with a company that Fritz Wolf had founded called Katerra. And yeah. I actually had learned about Katerra a long, long time ago. Jesse Wolf, and I'm pretty close with the Wolf family, and they're tight with Gonzaga, of course. But, and I had heard about Katerra a long time ago, probably 5 or 10 years prior to actually going there. It had been something that Fritz had been talking about for a long time, really just trying to figure out how to optimize construction for multifamily housing, really, and extract margins that could make family housing more affordable in the biggest cities in the country. And so I saw Fritz Wolf Sr., old Fritz, as we call him. I saw him do speak to a group at Gonzaga University in the auditorium there with some friends of mine. I happened to be in Spokane. We went and watched Fritz talk about this project. And I kind of left there thinking, that's incredible. And so about a year later, I had managed to really kind of decide to make this decision, talk to Fritz about coming to work for Katerra and what that would look like. I mean, I'm not an architect, I'm not an engineer. So really I entered that company as really a liaison between private equity and the Wolf company, their development company, and managed that relationship between some of those entities. So it was fascinating. I was there for almost 3 years. And so I got the bug to build something, is my point. And when you are around those kind of people building something from scratch, it's very addictive. Okay. And it's like, I built a practice and built a business over 22 years in wealth management, but it's different when you're doing something on that scale. And it happened to spend a lot of time around some very, very bright people in the Bay Area, in Menlo Park, and in the Seattle area in our offices. And so it was an incredible experience that really kind of mostly drove me to what I'm doing right now. So
interesting. And I think I was at that presentation.
Yeah.
Did he tell the story about the Olympia Brewery?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. What he called the biggest real estate mistake of his career. Look, the bottom line is when Fritz Wolf talks, I listen, because it's just, if you don't, you're an idiot, basically. And young Fritz was, he's had such an incredible business career doing all sorts of things. And to say he's just a real estate developer would be just a big grave error, because he is an investor globally. And as much time as you can get to spend with those guys, and they're so generous with their time and their resources with the community. Some people maybe just forget that part of it, but it means a lot to me, and I'm lucky to have those guys as friends. So anyway, it was quite an experience. So
that's awesome.
And yeah,
I agree wholeheartedly, and I do not know. Does he go by Fritzy?
Well, to me, he does. I don't know. I've known him a long time. So to me, he's Fritzy, but I don't think people call him that in the real world. But so
very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and then Katerra wraps up probably sometime during COVID, I would imagine.
Yeah. COVID was tough. Was tough on the business. I ended up leaving Katerra during COVID. Had about a year where I was really just doing some consulting, and then really kind of just stumbled upon this project, and then away things went from there. So, yeah.
So can you take me to the beginning? Is how does one stumble upon the project? I mean, my recollection, I mean, I know there was this stadium vote in Spokane and ultimately the decision to move the stadium downtown. How all that, because there's got to be a million pieces going on to the extent you can share.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I think what it boils down to is I just saw something either on social media or maybe on LinkedIn about the stadium. I follow Spokane news pretty closely. My folks live here still. I was very involved in Spokane for a long time in a number of things. And I really just was fascinated by what had happened with the downtown stadium project. I mean, it was never supposed to be that way, right? The Spokane Public Schools had in 2018 had a $500 million bond that was passed that included about $32 million to renovate the old Joe Albee Stadium out in Northwest Spokane. So long before I got involved with this, the USL, which is the United Soccer League, their COO at the time had passed through Spokane on his way to Hayden Lake to visit a college friend who had a home there. And, you know, the USL is the fastest growing and it's the largest professional soccer league in North America. And so, but they had not kind of opened up, let's say, the West. They are based out of Tampa, Florida, and most USL clubs kind of were, the leagues really started in the Southeast and have grown towards the West, but they had not really happened out here yet. And so opening up on the Northwest corner of the country via Spokane was a huge deal. There, you know, there at some point there could be a USL club that's a pro team in the Seattle area, whether or not it's maybe north a bit or something, but you know, the Sounders are the big dog over there. And Spokane for me with a brand new stadium. Anyway, let me back up. USL spent a great deal of money and a great deal of time convincing the downtown businesses, the school board, et cetera, to put a stadium downtown. They basically came in and were like, forget out north in the northwest corner where there's really no hustle, bustle. Nobody wants to go out there. I mean, you and I probably went out there for football games in high school. Yep. Joe Albee was a gem, but what it wasn't was an economic driver for the area, right? And so the fact that USL came in and spent a year and a half convincing the school board to reallocate those dollars to downtown, it was an incredible feat. So that's the part for me that got my attention, because if you can build a stadium in downtown Spokane, I just felt like, wow, kind of the sky's the limit there. And pro soccer, I grew up as a soccer guy. That was my sport. And all of my kids are very sporty and none of them went and played soccer. They all kind of left the soccer world after eighth grade. They gravitated towards basketball and football and volleyball, which is great. But I understand soccer and what it can be to a community. And so, you know, USL's plan was to put a pro men's team, a Division III pro men's team in the stadium, along with an amateur women's team. And so I picked up the phone and I called Cindy Chipman and I wanted to hear more about what this was all about. And about 90 minutes later, I went down the hallway to, Katie was working out of our office in our bedroom actually. And I basically, she was on a call I think, and I just popped the door open to the bedroom and I'm like, hey, I'm going to buy a soccer club, professional soccer club, and put it in Spokane in this brand new stadium that's just starting to be built. But don't worry. I'm going to put a pro women's team there too. Because what I decided on that phone call was I'm not going to do this for just a men's team. I had really become a huge follower and fan of some of the clubs that were being kind of springing up in the NWSL, specifically Angel City FC. And I certainly would not compare Spokane to the LA market. But what Angel City was doing down there in building a brand that was totally and fully immersed and engaged with the community. Now, the LA community is huge. I mean, there's 10 million people in LA, but Spokane is a sports town. And with a stadium downtown, I just felt like this is an opportunity to found something, fill a big gap in for people in Spokane in terms of sports entertainment, and create a culture and a club that I just had a very clear vision of what it could do in the community with kids, with accessibility and everything else. And Gonzaga basketball really, I mean, it's obviously put Spokane on the map. I went to Gonzaga. But back when I was a kid, you could walk right into a Gonzaga basketball game with no ticket. And, and for me, much as I love Gonzaga basketball to this day, it is not accessible to the public. And I wanted to create something that was. So this is that 2.5 years later. So that's the very abbreviated version of what happened. And And when Katie and I decided to do this fully after a whole lot of deep diving into what does it even mean to own a soccer club? How do you, what do these clubs do? Am I like, what kind of money are we losing every year? And I went to USL and I was basically like, you know, yeah, I can do this. I know I can do it, but I want to see, you know, I want to see everything about every current pro team in your ecosystem. And I want to see how much money they're losing. I need to see all of it. So I just dug into it very deeply, talked to professional soccer team owners all over the world, and basically came to the conclusion that this is a terrible, terrible idea. and pro soccer is so difficult, pro sports in general, but this is a long-term investment that, generally speaking, does not pencil on a year-to-year basis. It's a difficult business to break even in. But the stadium, and it's the linchpin to the whole thing for me. So if you have a stadium where you can control and own marketing rights and have that revenue source, which we do, that was the only reason why I pushed through on this thing. And it should have died 150 times, by the way. This was very difficult to get across the line, and I'm glad it did, but it's no small task. And adding the women's team, USL eventually, I wouldn't do this deal unless they included the women's franchise in the whole thing. So Super League, which, you know, is really, you know, now it's a Division I sanctioned league through US Soccer. The women's side was really the asset that I wanted in the club. I knew the men's team would do well. I knew that we would fill up that stadium. I knew we could put on a great game day. I knew we could get the guys out in the community. I knew that would work just fine. The women's team is what Katie and I really wanted to focus most of our resources towards. And at the time, it was Super League was just it was going to be launched as a Division II team, and right below NWSL. But over the course of about a year, other owners throughout the country who wanted to do a women's pro team, we all came together and basically told the league, we want this to be a Division I sanctioned league. There's no reason for it not to be at that level. And Spokane, by virtue of our ownership group and the support, corporate support that we've had, season ticket deposits, the league allowed us to put a Super League team here when we really have no business being in a Division I sport in Spokane. The other markets that are launching this year with Super League are Washington, D.C. and Brooklyn, New York, Dallas. I mean, we're up at Fort Lauderdale. I mean, we're in big markets, Charlotte. So they basically, we kind of just told them, we're not doing this without the other team. And then we all pushed pretty hard to make this a Division I sanctioned league. So we're building the league alongside USL, which has been incredibly fascinating. So
when you say Division I, you mean top flight, right?
Yeah. So the women's team is plays at the same level as the NWSL, which has been around for 14, 15 years. And our players are coming from those teams. We've got a lot of players on our roster in Spokane who have been playing pro soccer with it in the NWSL. Overseas. The interesting thing about women's sports, and the reason why we did this, is if you were a high performing female soccer player in any college program in the US, but we'll just focus on Division I play, you really had one league to go play in after you graduated, and that was the NWSL. Now, at the time that we did this, there were 12 teams in the NWSL, and let's just be generous and say they had a 30 person roster on each of those teams. So there's 360 women who get to go play pro soccer after they graduate from college. And we've got tens of thousands of female soccer players coming out. And what do? Well, they just stop, and they don't get drafted. They're either stopping play or they're going overseas to try and play in Europe or Australia or another country where there might be more opportunities, because they're just further ahead than we are here in the US. And so, Super League this year launched with 8 teams. Division I sanctioning is really a product of market size, where these clubs are located. Do they have a stadium that is 7,500 people or higher And we don't have that in Spokane, but the league has to average that. And so it worked out. We have a 5,000 plus person stadium. Most of the other Super League teams have 10, 12, you know, 14,000 people. And next year there'll be some other large cities joining the Super League, and they're also in bigger markets. I mean, Spokane and Lexington also got a Super League franchise, and really by virtue of their ownership group, economic strength of their ownership group, their market, and they're building a brand new stadium. They're investing right now in a brand new stadium that'll be done really soon, this fall. And it's spectacular. And so Spokane's lucky in that we were able to pull this off. And now, 1 month from now, we got to try and fill that stadium up for our first game. And we sold a lot of season tickets for Zephyr. But the Division I standard is just, it's complying with U.S. Soccer Federation's requirements to be at the highest level. So there's things that go along with that that are outside of the stadium size. There's pay, there's benefits. You have to meet some of these requirements. As a matter of fact, you have to meet all of them, really. So we knew we could do that, and we wanted to form an investment group that would stand behind the women's game, because it's so much more expensive to do than the men, because of its sanctioning. So,
and is there relegation in the USL structure?
Not yet. USL in the United States, there is no promotion relegation. MLS is the only Division I sanctioned league at the moment, I would say. But MLS is a closed league, okay? Meaning there's no crossover. They're a closed league. The MLS owns every team in the league. So there's what, 30 teams across the country in big markets. Those teams have owners locally to operate the franchise and put on the game day and things like that. But player contracts are owned by the league, and the league is made up of all the owners. Okay. And so the USL has a different model. Like we in Spokane, we own all of our player contracts. We can sell players. We can collect transfer fees. The USL doesn't take any of those. So it's a very different model. Promotion relegation can happen within USL at some point, and we've talked about it. It's an ongoing discussion between our league, which is League One, Division Three, and League and Championship League within USL, which is Division Two sanctioned. There's 24 teams in Division Two Championship League. And next year there'll be 16 teams in League One. So we're building that towards that conversation.
Yeah.
But it's Pro Rel has been around, as you know, all over the world for a long time. It's everything, and it means everything from a competition standpoint. Bringing games of consequence to fans is what Pro Rel is all about, right? Of course, there's economics tied to it on these mature leagues in Europe and whatnot. There's media rights deals that have huge amounts of monetary consequences with being promoted and being relegated. We're a long ways from that in the U.S., but USL, our ownership group, we're in conversations all the time with other owners in Championship League and League One about how to, and with the league, of course, about how to structure that. What does it look like? What are the economics of it? And I, of course, if you talk to League One owners like us, we're all for it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Championship League owners are terrified of it because in general, they've paid higher franchise fees. They have higher operating costs. But I'm always like, well, that's the beauty of Pro Rel. Like, that's what makes it exciting for fans. There's risk there. And so we're working through all of that. And it's a process that will take, a couple more years to get it all nailed down. It's every now and then it pops up in the news and people wonder if we're going to be voting on it at a meeting. And we haven't done that yet. It's still in the conversation phase. So.
Yeah, and I also see something about the I want to call it the U.S. Open or the Open Tournament, where you have
the Open Cup,
the Open Cup, Lamar Hunt Open Cup, right? I don't know
the women's Open Cup is great. I mean, Open Cup is a 120-year-old tournament that basically U.S. Soccer Federation sponsors. Everybody who is within these pro leagues can participate in it. And there's a route by which amateur clubs can qualify to be in the US Open Cup. And it took a little bit of a twist this year because MLS decided they didn't want to put all their first teams in it. And right. It caused a big uproar. And there's a whole podcast to do about that on another time with another, probably another host, like Benji Wade. But Open Cup is a spectacular tournament, and it allows, it's that whole David versus Goliath, you know, right. It's still going on. There's two, I think there were in the semifinals. There are three MLS teams in the semifinals and one USL club from Championship League. Our club, we went into the third round. We won our first two games. We hosted a game here in Spokane. I'm not sure if you're at it, but we won in Seattle against an amateur club, which is not really an amateur club. Ballard FC in Seattle is amateur, but they are a powerful, very, very well-run club over there. That's in USL's League Two. And they won the national championship in League Two last year with, you know, 75 or 80 teams across the country. Wow. But we won that game. And then we hosted LA Force, which was another, you know, another professional team from the Los Angeles area. We beat them here in Spokane 1-0. Great game. And then we lost to a USL championship team in Las Vegas in the third round. So, but it's one of those tournaments where, you know, you try and just knock off the big guys, you know, right. And keep rolling. And we were very, very close to doing that. And if we had won our game in Las Vegas, then we lost it in overtime. I don't know if you watched that game, but we tied that game. We were losing that game until about 90 seconds to go. And Andre Lewis, who on our team, just cracked a 35-yard banger and tied it up. And then we ended up losing an extra time in the added time period. And if we had won that game, I think we would have played the Seattle Sounders in the following round.
Wow, that would be cool.
Yeah,
that's fun. I think I missed that game. And I've been to a couple games. And there was another cup, too, that I went to, I want to say. And I can't remember what it was called. It was a sponsored cup
competition. Yeah.
But take me to, and I'll say this. I mean, you've got a tremendous product. We did the March to the Match. I took my 8-year-old, even though it was like 108 degrees, still super fun. Got into the stadium, had an awesome time. And then my son at the end, with about 10 minutes left, he's like, let's go down to where the people that we marched with.
Yeah, the
sports group. Syndicate were sitting. Yeah. Let's go check it out. Yeah. So we go down there, and then the coolest part was at the end of the game, right? The players are coming over, talking to us. We're taking pictures. We're hanging out, and that was an awesome experience all around. So you're definitely delivering, and I would say that the David versus Goliath, you know, with Zags basketball, at least at one point, maybe they're more of a Goliath now, but that certainly rings true in Spokane. So I love that. Take me to so you're the point guy, and then now you got to get an ownership group together. How does that work? What are you doing?
I mean, look, this, you know, first of all, I will say this. I mean, a sports franchise ownership is evolving right now. And it used to be that the governing bodies of all of these major leagues, okay, NBA, NFL, all of them, really wouldn't allow private equity in. Okay. Right. They were really, at one point, all of these major league sports teams were just billionaire, passion projects, vanity projects, call them what you want. It's really expensive to purchase these things and to operate them. And so that's evolving. And that's part of what was, you know, for me, Katie and I mean, Katie probably thought it was insane to think that we should go do this. But to me, again, I will just say it seemed fairly doable to me. There's capital out there that wants to be in pro team ownership,
right?
Even at the Division III level within USL. And we had the added benefit within our entity of having a women's team. Okay. And so when I hatched this idea to go do this, I knew that it was going to be not just our capital. Okay. Ryan and Katie Harnato have capital in this project that's meaningful, but I knew that we needed far more than what we were, you know, willing to put into something like this. And so, and frankly, you want an ownership group that's engaged and local. And so we have partners. When we launched the club and ended up purchasing the rights from USL, we brought in Jordan and Whitney Tampion, and Jordan's a Gonzaga grad, law school as well, MBA. And Jordan is a really, you know, he's an immense, immense personality who has spent a lot of years developing downtown Spokane projects. And trying to, you know, he's one of those developers who has taken a focus on making downtown better, bringing people to live downtown. And I actually met Jordan during this whole process while we were kind of secretly talking to corporate partners who had known that this was going to happen. And there was some conversations happening pretty regularly with corporate partners about how they could be involved. And Katie and I met Jordan and just, you know, kind of felt like, you know, he was a personality that, you know, he's got different entities that he owns, health clubs, Brick West Brewing, other things, real estate. He was just really a good personality fit for us. So Jordan and his wife and Katie and I are the primary owners of this club. And what we did is I basically went out and talked to some folks locally and outside of Spokane who had an interest in supporting our mission. We have a very clear mission with this club. The women's asset within the club was a huge driver for everybody who's come in. We're incredibly, we're pretty particular about who we've invited into this ownership group. We could always get more capital. And frankly, I turned down a lot of people who wanted to come into the club and who I just didn't know. People who heard about the project, reached out, wanted to come in, people from all over the country, people at family offices, people who were running sports funds. But at the end of the day, this was something that was going to be ours. We had a very clear vision of what we wanted to build, and we didn't want outside influence. And when you take outside money, you get influence from them. So we have minority owners that have participated in this club for the long term, and they know that this isn't going to be spitting off dividends right away. But club values do tend to go up over time. And this is an enterprise value play over the next 5 to 10 years. And so we all are in this for the long run. And we brought in people like Joe and Katie Herzog, and some other folks from Spokane who we've made these names public. So not a mystery. We've got about 7 partners within our ownership group, including one entity from LA, operated by a former NBA player, Josh Childress, who played at Stanford. Triana Allen is a partner at Landspire. She's a Gonzaga grad, played basketball at Gonzaga, coached women's basketball at Gonzaga. And we have some other people in that ownership group who remain anonymous, who are Gonzaga folks. And so we've kept it local as much as we can because we love having boots on the ground and people here who will, you know, advocate for the club and be and just get the mission. You know what I mean? So it's expensive as heck. And people, I mean, I came from a business where people are giving you millions of dollars to manage money for them. And this to me was the same type of ask. Look, we look for people who understand the stadium as the primary driver for the investment opportunity long term. We have a 20-year lease on that stadium. We needed people to understand and get behind women's sports, and we needed people who were either huge soccer fans or just big fans of building this in Spokane. So the three drivers that I had looking for partners were those three, and if they had 2 out of the 3, I would talk to them. And if they only had 1 out of 3, forget it. Because I can't convince somebody what the investment case is behind women's sports. I just can't do that. Like, if they don't get it, I can't talk to them. I can't waste my time. And so everybody who's in our ownership group, just, they get it. They, you know, they understand what's going on in the world with women's sports as an investment. And it's actually raising capital it hasn't been difficult. It's just for me, the difficult part is finding the right partners. And again, our entity is structured such that, you know, it's Ryan Harnato and Katie Harnato driving all the decisions for this club. We don't have a board of directors. That's not how it's structured. It's more like a private equity fund. And so with us in the GP. So when we say it's, you know, a family affair, we really do mean it. It's small. The thing is being pushed forward by us, and we control everything that happens with the club.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now I recall, this is kind of random, but in the 90s, we had a shadow where a club was at a USL team. There was a Spokane shadow. They played out at Albee. It was a horrible place to play football.
So, yeah. I mean, the shadow used to play a long time ago. The USL, under the USL's present ownership structure, I think it actually used to be a USL club at an amateur club.
Okay.
They say semi-pro. When you hear the word semi-pro, it just means amateur. I don't know why they call it that. Do you know what I mean? Shadow has been around for a long time. They have a great product. They have great players. We actually, our Velocity team, people probably don't realize this, but we played them earlier this year in preseason. And it was terrific. And they have a terrific product. As a matter of fact, I think they're in playoffs right now. And so anyway, they were, I believe, in an older version of USL prior to the Papadakis family basically buying the USL, which is the current version of it that they've had for like 13 or 14 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but semi-pro is just amateur, and I don't mean to, I'm not downplaying it, because there's very good players who still play for the Shadow, and they gave our brand new Velocity team early this year, they gave us a real problem in a scrimmage we had right after our team was formed, which is normal because we brought players in from all over the world who had never played together, but we beat them. But we actually lost to the Gonzaga team preseason as well. We had GU in a closed game at One Spokane Stadium, and we lost that game, I think 2-1. And Gonzaga came to play. And, you know, when early in the season, when you're experimenting with rosters and lineups, sure, and things like that, nobody, I mean, it was a great game, and hats off to GU, because they came in there, you know, wanting to prove something, and they did. They're very tough. So it was fun. Yeah.
How do you find players? How do you bring them in? I mean, obviously you have someone who does that, an expert. I don't know if it's the.
Yeah. I mean, for the pro teams, we've got a really, really good staff, and players find us, first of all. I mean, when my name got out there a year and a half ago as being the person who was going to own this club, I mean, I got players hit me up on social media, on LinkedIn, sending me tape. I'm like, I'm not your guy. we have an incredible staff who has decades of experience in MLS and in USL Championship League and League One and college football. I mean, I say football, college soccer. So we have an excellent staff that does an incredible job at recruiting, and players have agents, and agents find us. It's going to be our recruiting of players happens in a variety of ways, but mostly it's relationships. It's our head coach came from the Charleston Battery, which is USL Championship League, Division II. You know, he came with, you know, they're looking at hundreds and hundreds of players all the time. And we get some of the ones we want, and we lose some of the other ones. But we're very specific in the kind of player we're looking for. We are focused on high character, high performance, and high character first. And a lot, I mean, one bad apple can just absolutely destroy the culture that we're trying to build and wreck a locker room. And so we're very careful, but we have a staff of five or six people who are doing the due diligence on these players. And literally it takes two text messages to find out if a player is scorched earth or not. You know, we find out. And some of our players are veterans who've been around the leagues for, you know, 10, 12 years as a pro, some 5 or 6 years. Some are coming right out of college. Some never went to college. And we get them from all different sources. And it's complicated. But I will say this, the technology that we have makes it fast to evaluate a player. And that you know, from video, we watch video, and when I say we, I'm not talking about myself. I've got a very good amateur eye for this. I mean, I'm not the guy selecting players. I right. certainly appreciate who we have. I certainly would weigh in on somebody. I don't get involved in it until there's a contract that has to be signed. I don't negotiate those contracts unless they're get to a level that's large enough where I, you know, raise an eyebrow and want to know more about a player and why we're taking that kind of risk. Our contracts are guaranteed. You know, we've lost a couple players this year to injury for the season, and those are expensive things to have happen because right. we got to go find other players. We're a little light right now on our roster because we got guys that are hurt. But we're also trying to run a business here, and your roster can just, it can creep expense wise. It can creep higher very, very quickly. Our players. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, to your point, I mean, I saw it on Ted Lasso, you know, you have one rotten apple in that locker room and, you know, the rest. So if it's on Ted Lasso, it must be true, but,
it is true. Yeah.
But it sounds like you're very culture focused in the way you describe kind of, I guess, what we call the back office. Hey, I need the right people, yeah. right ownership, right team. Same thing in the locker room or in the clubhouse.
Yeah, we're really intentional on who we hire. I mean, it's just like you get one chance to do this right from the beginning. And Katie and I really felt like culture eats strategy for breakfast. It's a long, long time, you know, phrase coined by, I can't remember who said it, but we believe that you just have to get the right people in the office. And so we started kind of picking people off from within the community, and we brought people in from out of state. We have an incredible staff. Many of them have no experience in pro sports. There's a learning curve there. The speed at which stuff happens is the biggest thing for our front office. But our soccer ops VP worked for LA Galaxy for 15 years. He was in the MLS with another club prior to that. He was in USL Championship League. And you have to bring in those professionals who've been in the ecosystem, because there's so much to it that you got to understand. And we didn't have anybody locally who could do that. There's incredible coaches in Spokane as an example, but you know, we had 150 people apply for our Velocity head coaching job from 22 different countries. And wow. and our sporting director, his job is to whittle that down to about 10 people who then Katie and I can come and talk to, and we can get involved at that point. And because again, you want your culture within the team gets built from your head coach. Your head coach's culture comes from us and our values. And we were incredibly clear. I'm not going to bore you with it, but like, if you don't write down what your values are, like good night, it doesn't work. And we were really intentional about the things that were important to us in how we wanted to govern our decisions with this club. And we can always find them right here. And that's kind of Amazonian. And Katie brought that in, and I'm a big believer in it. It's like, you have to have a framework for how you make decisions as a club. Otherwise, you're just flying blind. Do you know what I mean? And so this is critical to us. Hiring the right people was critical. Paying them well was important to us. We wanted to provide good jobs in Spokane. So we've got a really good mix of kind of veteran industry people within marketing and other sectors. We stole Dave Sontag from Gonzaga, as you probably know, quality guy. I've known Dave Sontag for a long time. He's done an incredibly great job of getting our marketing and our brand launched. He's been with us almost a year, I think, now, but it's hard to build the right office staff and find the right players and coaches. And that's why we take more time than I think probably anybody else in League One, for sure. No offense to the other ownership groups, but we take our time. And so we're proud of that.
You talked earlier about kind of the community out even beyond the club, right? As a, like, this is going to be an integrated part of Spokane culture, Spokane community.
Yeah.
You guys made a move, I think, and maybe you can give some of the details that I thought was really impressive, is that you limited the number of season tickets Yeah. So you could have people that could basically walk up or get game day or match day tickets.
Yeah.
Very unlike what's happening in McCarthy Athletic Center where everything's
But again, I can't knock the product over at Gonzaga. They've built an incredible program there and I have the utmost respect for it. It's just not accessible. One of my investors who was looking at coming into our ownership group, and I'm very glad that they did, asked me during the process of considering this investment, it's a classic VC question. It's like, what problem are you trying to solve with this club? A very fair question, right? And it was super easy to answer. I basically was like, look, this doesn't exist in Spokane. So there's a gap. You can't go to a Gonzaga game. Okay. You just can't go. It's terrific in that way that they get sellouts every game and the women do too, but you can't go to a men's basketball game unless someone's out of town and has tickets to give you. And the rare occasion where they'll do a game in the arena, you might have a shot at that for sure. Or if you want to travel to Seattle, you can do it. But the gap here, was Spokane has a thriving soccer community. First of all, I mean, there's 15,000 youth players in this region. And by region, I mean Spokane, Coeur d'Alene, you know, Kootenai County, Spokane County. There's 1 million people in our region. Spokane is 570,000 or something in Spokane County. We pull in Coeur d'Alene. There's a ton of kids that, you know, this is an entertainment source for them. And again, all due respect to the Spokane Chiefs and the Spokane Indians who have put on a great product for decades, that we just don't have overlap with that fan base.
Right.
The soccer fan is different than a hockey, minor league hockey and minor league baseball and soccer have about 5% crossover with our fan base. That's it. So there's a whole bunch of people who didn't have anything to go to unless they wanted to trek to Seattle and see a Sounders game or go to Portland and see a Timbers game. And so the problem we are trying to solve is, gosh, we have this downtown stadium now. We're really an entertainment company. Okay. The soccer on the pitch is just part of what we do. As you pointed out at the beginning of this podcast, it's like, we knew we would put a great product on the pitch because we put resources towards our roster. We hired great coaches. This is very expensive to do. But we invested the right amounts into it, but the rest of it is what Katie and I are focused on the most. It is, what can we do to provide a game day experience that is affordable, accessible, family friendly, offers a different type of entertainment? And beyond that, how do we go out with our club? Because we've always viewed this as a platform, just a platform. I mean, soccer is a platform in communities like this, to go out and do good, you know. Yeah. We just have a great deal of responsibility to use the club as a platform to go bring people together, raise awareness, keep kids engaged in sports, provide the best coaching resources we can to the clubs in the area who already have great coaches. But we've brought 10 coaches into the Spokane area from all over the world. It's incredible. So we're here to serve. And that piece of this whole investment is the crux of why we did this. We love the matches. I love winning more than anybody, but the real thing that we're doing is we want to impact the community at large. And I think people are starting to really feel it. And I will tell you this, the men have been great, but the women, like, I've been spending time around them in the last month. They've been here. They got here early. They got there. I mean, they are a very high level of athlete, and they're just also different in the community. They want to be out there as much as they can. They're engaged with kids. We're already doing it. And they're really fun to be around. So we're just trying to spread some of that soccer love, you know, which is unlike, I think, any other sport. I really do.
Yeah. And their opening match is coming up. Is it next month? You said
August 17th. And really, really so far, you know, getting back to your comment about season tickets, we've sold about half the stadium out for men. The women we've sold about 25% of the stadium out in season tickets for women. We'll get to that number of around 2,200, 2,300. We'll get there at some point over the next 6 to 12 months. But we want those seats to be open for people to come and enjoy it. So they open on August 17th, and you can buy season tickets right now for Zephyr. but we will open up single game ticket sales in a couple of days. And that's really when we'll start to kind of fill up the stadium for that August 17th home opener. And it'll be historic. We had 5,100 people there for the Velocity home opener. The Zephyr home opener will probably be the same or more, standing room only kind of thing. It'll be a spectacular event.
I mean, that I'll say there's not a bad seat in the stadium. No. And the matches I've been to, I mean, you can hear the players talk. I feel like I'm on the field, actually.
Well, you were on the field. That's where I found you.
Well, I was. I did be on the field after the game. But like,
no, yeah.
Javi Martin was up on our side. We're talking. I mean, it was awesome. It was awesome. We could hear what they were saying. You know, it was.
It's the state. Look, the stadium is spectacular. And our ownership group put $4 million into that stadium. And,
wow.
You know, the PFD and the Spokane Public Schools, you know, they put the real estate into it and the resources for the stadium and the money that we invested, which was part of the deal that we bought and inherited from USL, was, you know, we agreed to put $4 million in upgrades in that stadium. And so people kind of forget that sometimes, wow. But we spent, you know, $1.5 million on a locker room. We bought that $1 million video board and digital field ribbon to kind of really up level the experience. We split some costs with the PFD on a hospitality areas up top on the west side. All of the seating that is on the west side that are chairs with backs, seat backs, not bleachers, but seats with backs and cup holders, we paid for all of that. Awesome. We really did that because we wanted to change, you know, the situation for the, you know, the fan experience, right? And we really turned it from a great municipal stadium into a more of a commercial venue. And the other thing about that is, like, there's five high schools that call that stadium home for football and soccer, men and women's soccer. It's like and that's the whole premise behind the stadium coming downtown, is they had five high schools that needed new space. Right. And so the high schools that get to utilize that, I mean, it's an incredible venue for them, and they get to use every single thing that's in there, which is awesome. So
that is awesome. That is awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I want to be respectful of your time, and we're getting near the end. And as always, I'll close with first a thank you. You're awesome. Yeah. This has been an awesome conversation.
Yeah.
Love it. You were talking about the soccer scene in Spokane. I was actually going to meet your cousin, John.
Yeah.
We stumbled on the Columbia watch party for the semifinal.
Yeah.
There was 150. I didn't know there was that many Colombianos in Spokane. It was awesome.
Yeah, good.
Going crazy. Of course, we're rooting for what was then the home team at that point.
Yeah.
Because it was, I mean, I see where you're at, but advice for Zags about ready to embark.
Yeah. I mean, look, I would just say this. Like, I mean, for me, I got started a little bit late with this. I didn't really totally know I should be doing this till I was, you know, 46 or 7. I mean, go get experience. And if you can do it, find things that you are passionate about. It will make your life so much more enjoyable and so much easier if you can just find a discipline work-wise that, you know, you've got a skill set for, that you're passionate about. People who I talk to about the club, whether they're investors or other, they can see it on my face that I believe in this project, believe in what we're doing. It's very easy to talk about. I think the biggest advice I would give, you know, people is just be true to yourself. When you get out of school and you're thinking about your future, don't take the easy road. Make sure you love what you're doing. Otherwise, it's an absolute disaster. And seek mentors. That's one of the biggest things for me. I think it's a difficult market to go out into right now. And you just really want to know where you're headed and why. That's the biggest thing. It's like, we know that Gonzaga and other universities produce great, great students, but what does that mean? Right. You've got to go out and find your why. Forget everything else. I was a poli sci major. What am I doing? This kid tracked me down on LinkedIn for like 4 months straight, wanted to get on a call with me. He went to the University of Virginia, and I love people who like bird dog stuff. And I'm like, I don't know, like, I'm not like a celebrity, but I don't know why he was trying so hard. Finally, I agreed to talk to the kid. He we got on a call, and he goes, and he was from outside the US. He was like a presidential scholar at the University of Virginia, really bright kid, young. And he was just fascinated by what I had done or what I was doing. And he said to me, what made you think? Now, there was a little bit of a language barrier here, but, and this is how he said it. He said, what made you think that you studied political science and you were in wealth management? What made you think that you could go do what you're doing? And what he meant was different than how it sounded, but I took it. I laughed because I'm like, good question. I'm like, shit, I don't know. I'm like, valid. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this, but I got a kick out of it. But the reality is, I think you can go do anything you're passionate about. And there's always resources available for, you know, launching new businesses. And I was entrepreneurial for a long time, building my practice and everything, and it was a lot of work. It was hard, but, Go do something that you're passionate about. Keep inventing things. I wish I'd started earlier. I'm definitely not done. As soon as this is like rolling along at a pretty good clip, I'm sure I'll advance it in some way or do something similar. But yeah, I guess that's all I'd say. Follow, make sure it's a passion. So
love it. Yeah. Love it. Appreciate you.
Appreciate it.
Spokane.
Yeah. Let's go Zags.
Go Zags.
See you at the next game.
Forza Zephyr and go Velocity. I don't know what he'd say. Come on. I don't know. I'm thinking of the European
stuff. Go you Zephyr. I don't know. We let the fans figure that stuff out.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, let the supporters club figure that out. Exactly, all right, man. Exactly. Cheers.
All right. Take care, man. Great to see you. All right. Have a good one.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business. It was edited by yours truly, Margie Allgaard. Go forth and set the world on fire, and go Zags.